Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. In California, the massive campfire continues to burn. The death toll has risen to at least 66, and the Butte County Sheriff's Department says more than 600 people are missing. Some of those people may be safe, but have not yet contacted officials to tell them they're okay. In all, 9,700 homes have been destroyed, and some 13,000 people in and around Butte County are displaced. Hundreds of them are taking refuge in a Walmart parking lot in nearby Chico, California. As NPR's Frank Morris reports, many say it's a good place to be for now.
A week after driving through flames to escape the inferno in paradise, Jessamy Cartwright sits bundled up against the cold on a metal folding chair, surveying the same parking lot where she landed the morning her town and her home went up in smoke.
There was nowhere to go, so we just came here, and slowly but surely it filled up.
What started as a trickle of campfire evacuees has mushroomed into a sprawling community, dozens of tents, and lived-in cars spilling over with clothes, food, and dogs. Neighborhoods are forming around friendships forged in a town that no longer exists.
Absolutely. Yeah, everybody found one another, and we're sticking together. Definitely.
Tammy Mazera is living in a cluster of tents in the so-called Wallywood section of this improvised town.
It created another sense of community that was lost. It's almost like you lose your church, you lose the neighborhood store that you see somebody, you know, you lose that neighbor next door, you know, so this is recreated here in a micro spot, but, you know, this is our new sense. I think that's what everybody needs most right now.
But this place has evolved to take care of all kinds of needs.
What do you need?
I'm just looking for a Band-Aid. Yesterday,
you know what? And young lady, you need a mask.
I do.
Tables have sprung up at the far end of the parking lot, offering all kinds of services, from hot tea to cell phone charges to health care. Julia Urbanowitz, a nursing student, just showed up here with boxes and boxes of donated medical supplies.
And then I heard that Walmart was starting a whole little city here, so we decided to come by and see what they needed, and there was nothing medical going on, so we just, out of just compassion, we didn't want people to be walking around sick or, you know, potentially missing something that could, you know, make them get sicker.
Dozens of volunteers sort free clothes, blankets, and camping gear. They fix and serve thousands of hot meals a day. People wander around giving out gift cards, sometimes $100 bills. Somebody set up porta potties and hand washing stations. And here's the thing, nobody's really in charge. This happened on its own.
Thank you. The outpouring of support from the community has been tremendous.
Susan Keskonen is camped out here with her daughter and son-in-law.
It's hard to let yourself get into a depression when you've got people. We had coffee brought to our tent to this morning. I mean, and people, somebody's doing our laundry. A laundry company came in and handed out bags, and they're doing our laundry. And it's hard to fall apart when there's so much support, really. It's great.
The fire stripped these evacuees of everything they owned. And at least for the time being, that goes for people whose stuff was spared, like Dustin Kimball, living here in a tent.
No, I'd like to get back. I have a motorhome sitting at my mom's house waiting for us.
It's okay?
Yeah, it's okay. My mom's house is good, and my motorhome's sitting there, but I can't get up there.
The whole area is cordoned off, and residents are told likely will be for many weeks. Meantime, the wait goes on in the Walmart parking lot. Tammy Mazera says shock is giving way to foreboding.
There's a lot of uncertainty, and like this has been great. Like I said, the people have been phenomenal. We have a basic stabilization, but now we need to progress from that on a county, state, federal level. What can happen for me?
Lots of people here say they've yet to see any aid from the federal government. They say they'll need it to restart their lives when they leave this parking lot. And just last night, they learned they'll have to do that by Sunday. For Here and Now, I'm Frank Morris in Chico, California.
Well, today a federal judge ruled that the White House must return the press pass for CNN reporter Jim Acosta, which, as you know, was revoked after that contentious exchange last week during a press conference. Acosta came out of the court after the judge ruled in his favor.
I want to thank all of my colleagues in the press who supported us this week. And I want to thank the judge for the decision he made today. And let's go back to work.
Well, others are a little more cautious. The judge, a Trump appointee, based his ruling on Acosta's Fifth Amendment right to due process, which the judge said had been violated. The judge did not rule that reporters had a First Amendment right to free speech. And the White House then released this statement. Today, the court made clear that there is no absolute First Amendment right to access the White House. In response to the court, we will temporarily reinstate the reporter's pass. We'll also further develop rules and processes to ensure fair and orderly press conferences in the future. There must be decorum at the White House. And later in the morning after the ruling, President Trump spoke to reporters in the Oval Office and said, we are writing up rules and regulations. So at least it looks like they could possibly revoke his press pass again if they create a due process. But how is social media reacting? Joining us for our weekly social media news roundup is Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
What are you seeing?
Hi there. It's interesting that Judge Timothy Kelly also weighed in on the initial argument from the White House that Jim Acosta from CNN used force with the intern who was trying to take the microphone back from him after he asked a number of questions. And he said, as there was video circulating, now some of the video that was circulating was edited in a playful way, a mischievous way, but some of it was edited to make it look as if Jim Acosta had actually hurt or hit the intern in a forceful way. And the judge actually said that this is likely untrue and partly based on evidence of questionable accuracy. So everybody online who's debating about, is this real video? Did this really happen? The judge actually has weighed in on that as well. NT on Twitter is saying, but where in the Constitution does it say anyone can have a press pass? You laid out, Robin, why the judge made this decision so far. And NT is, I don't understand this. Debate continues about Jim Acosta's style of reporting when he is at White House briefing. So Serenity says, then maybe you should have Acosta reflect on his behavior and apologize to his colleagues whose time he monopolized.
So there are those who are supporting the White House in this.
Absolutely.
It's funny. I just have to say, funny you mentioned those videos because there were such funny videos of, you know, for instance, somebody had Jim Acosta then karate chopping with the young woman who was trying to take the microphone. So the judge actually weighed in and said those were funny. But
he wasn't talking about memes on Twitter, let's be clear. But he was talking about the initial assertion from the White House that he touched the young intern in an inappropriate way, likely untrue.
Huh.
And then, of course, there are the celebration memes. And one that caught my eye was a swagger from Woody the Cowboy from Toy Story swaggering through on his meme. And the person who shared this said, this is Jim Acosta walking back into the White House brief press room.
That'll be a moment.
I want to turn to another moment. And apparently it was just a moment, but caused a lot of clamor. This is what happened with Ed Scarry from the Washington Examiner, a reporter there, who tweeted a picture of Congresswoman-elect Alexandria Ocasio Cortez, and what she was wearing as she was on Capitol Hill, and it looked to be, it was a shot from the back, and she was wearing basically a dark suit and carrying a dark bag. But he had a caption that suggested that she might be more wealthy than she admits to being. There was fast and furious blowback. The reporter, Ed Scarry, eventually deleted the tweet, but there's a bigger picture here, Femi. Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was the picture was taken from the back, so there was some conversation online about it looking like it was a stalker picture. And the quote from Eddie Scarry was, I'll tell you something, that jacket and coat don't look like a girl who struggles. And this goes back to an original story about a week ago where the congresswoman was saying how difficult it was to be able to afford to move to Washington, D.C. before she officially gets her salary. And some people have been supporting that, saying, of course, if you're young, you're a millennial, and you're going into Congress and you don't come from a wealthy background, this is the reality. And then a lot of other people are mocking her. So the conversation escalated very, very quickly. Eddie Scarry called the congresswoman a girl. Dictionary.com, who does beautiful trolls, and she said, well, this is what a girl is. Noun, a female child from birth to full growth. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is not a girl. That is from a dictionary. And then others are using that, this doesn't look like a girl who struggles, exact wording, and then putting up ridiculous pictures of people in very flamboyant outfits. And so the trolling continues.
Yeah.
But the real sort of depth about this and the conversation about this is that if we're going to have a diverse Congress people, lawmakers, then they should be able to come from different backgrounds without being mocked about how much money they do or don't have. That's right. The deeper meaning right there.
Or feeling like they're being stalked.
Women are more than their clothes.
Yeah, there's that. And by the way, this is probably why a new study confirms that social media contributes to loneliness, depression, and anxiety. Because people are tweeting out pictures taken from the back of you and you don't even know it about the clothing that you're wearing. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, helping us take a look at the world through social media this week. Femi, thanks as always.
You're so welcome. I watch so much social media, I probably am lonely, anxious, and depressed, but it's always good to be on Here and Now. You cheer me up.
You hide it well, Femi. Thanks a lot. This is
You're
Here
welcome.
And Now.
You may have seen the hashtag, This Is My Lane. It's part of a huge online spat between emergency room and trauma doctors and the NRA. It started when the American College of Physicians issued a report calling for more research into guns as a public safety issue, to which the NRA tweeted out that self-important anti-gun doctors should stay in their lane and practice medicine rather than opine on firearm policy. Well, hours later, 12 people were shot and killed by a gunman at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California, and trauma doctors roared back. Dr. Daniel Kay wrote on Twitter, "Dear NRA, until you're covered in blood and pronounce someone dead in the trauma bay, or told a mother that her child is dead, or sewed someone's scalp together so their family doesn't have to see their brain matter, please don't tell me what my lane is." Dr. Howie Mel wrote, "Moments you always remember, furious honking in the ambulance bay, picking up the lifeless 12-year-old from the front seat like he weighed nothing, putting him on the cot, so many holes, no breathing, finger thoracostomy, his finger plugging a bullet hole, so much blood shooting up my arm, he died. Hashtag, this is my lane." Joseph Sacrin is trauma surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. He launched the This Is Our Lane page on Twitter. And Dr. Sacrin, you've also been sharing grim insights into treating gunshot victims, but you are also one of them?
That's correct. I was a victim of gun violence when I was 17. I was nearly killed after being shot in the throat with a .38 caliber bullet.
Now, this is during a high school football game, 1994. Am I hearing a little of that now? I mean, shot in the throat.
Yeah, so, you know, I actually have a paralyzed left vocal cord, and so I do have a little bit of a raspy voice. And, you know, when something like that happens at such a young age, it really changes your life. And this second chance that I got really inspired me to go into medicine, inspired me to become a trauma surgeon, and then really figure out how do we work at that intersection of medicine, public health, and public policy. Yeah.
In fact, you trained with the same surgeons who saved you to be the trauma surgeon that they are. And so now you see gunshot wounds every day. What do you think when you first saw these tweets from the NRA? Stay in your lane.
Well, you know, when I first saw that type of communication, I really was incensed. And it honestly was a clear demonstration to me, the rest of the medical community, and frankly, Americans all across this country, that they are not serious about moving this needle forward on this public health issue that we're facing.
Well, look, this has been going on for a long time. We remember Congress hasn't substantially funded gun violence research since 1996, and that was after the CDC got curious about the NRA claim that guns made homes safer, so they did research and found out, to officials' horror at the time, that in fact guns made homes far less safe. The NRA was so angry about that study, they went to Congress and lobbied to get funding for that kind of research cut off, and they essentially did with the Dickey Amendment, which is why we haven't seen this kind of research. You and all these other doctors now, and this study that came out that prompted the NRA tweet this time around, you know, are saying you need that research. Do you think you're going to get it?
The research piece is such an important point because gun violence has less than 1% of the research funding that other diseases, for example, like sepsis have, even though gun violence and sepsis kill about the same number of Americans every year. So having federal dollars to be able to figure out what are the solutions to dealing with this problem, similar to what we've done with motor vehicle fatalities in the 60s and 70s and tobacco, is going to be so critical to move this conversation forward and to really be able to implement appropriate solutions. This is about all of us united together. And so right now, a lot of us are in conversation with other organizations to team up with them to be able to, again, work together similar to what we have communicated, you know, with the NRA. We feel like everyone deserves to be a part of the solution. So we're not going to silo ourselves off. We are going to break down these silos and work with existing gun violence prevention organizations, gun owners, in order to really help move this conversation forward and implement action that's going to save lives and make communities safer.
But, you know, do you think that things have shifted? And you know, the response from the doctors would seem to indicate that maybe they have. Were you surprised? Lots of F-bombs in tweets and people saying, that must be my lane. Come into my lane. I've cared for victims of gun violence for the past 25 years. This is from one doctor. Another neurosurgeon shared a picture of a bloody bullet she'd removed from the brain of a six-month-old that had been shot. A trauma surgeon in New Jersey posted the picture of the blue plastic chair she sits in to tell parents their child has died. An emergency room doctor in Louisville sent a picture of blood just covering the floor. And as we said, a lot of rage. And by the way, can you try to explain where that comes from? We explain your world and working with gunshot victims.
Yeah, so let me just say that the medical community, those of us that are, you know, day in, day out taking care of these patients, we are literally on the front line. And so for some person or group to think that the medical community is not a part of this conversation, I think is sorely mistaken, because the reality is, you know, Robin, any complex health solution like this cannot be solved by simply one person or one organization. It requires stakeholders from all walks of life. And so when I have to walk into those waiting rooms and I have to talk to those mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and tell them that their loved one is not coming back, that type of experience that we have to go through every day, most people don't understand. Let me just talk broadly about what's happening in this country. Every day, over 95 people die from gun violence. Yeah. Every day. And that's not to mention, you know, the over 300 that are shot every day. And so, you know, when we talk about these mass shootings and which get a lot of the media coverage, I think one of the important things to remember is that's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, we have young black men that are being killed in our inner cities all across this country. And frankly, their story often goes untold.
Look, part of that tweet from the NRA, you know, it was stay in your lane, but also that you're too much in your lane, that doctors only talk amongst themselves and that they publish these papers in a vacuum with other doctors. Conservative commentator Ann Coulter tweeted out, emergency room doctors pull cue balls, vines, and gummy bears out of human orifices every week. That doesn't make them experts on pool, horticulture, or chewy candy. I mean, the point they're both making is that, you know, this doesn't make you an expert. I would presume you disagree.
I absolutely disagree. And actually, let me just take that a step further. You know, for them to say that we haven't engaged other groups or organizations is categorically false. In fact, the American College of Surgeons met with the leadership of the NRA in January of 2017 to try to determine how do we, you know, find some common ground in order to reduce firearm injury and death in this country. So it's not true.
And the editor of the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which that study was printed, said, we're not anti-gun, we're anti-bullet holes. Look, a doctor-founded group, Affirm, the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine, wrote a letter for doctors nationwide to co-sign, pointing out that the Thousand Oaks mass shooting was the 307th in 2018. And listed some of their concerns, which includes the devastating effects of bullets from high-capacity weapons. Do you see that? Is it that different, a bullet from a shotgun and one from an assault-type rifle?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in America, we see the full spectrum, anything from a handgun to, you know, the AR-15 and a lot of these mass shootings. And the pattern of injury can definitely be different. You know, the AR-15 really pulverizes tissue and causes a significant amount of destruction. So, you know, even if you didn't necessarily, you know, hit that specific piece of tissue, the blast effect might cause injury to it. Yeah. So they are very different.
Look, you survived a shooting. You carry it, obviously, are conscious of it. And now you see victims, you know, every day. Do you ever think, you know, the heck with you all. If you're, you know, if you're going to bow to the NRA, I'm going to France, you know, and take your life back from what is really kind of a grimness. Do you ever feel that way?
Absolutely not. I am an American. I love this country. And this is, let me just say, this is not about us versus the NRA or us versus anyone else. You know, I think when you look at the conversation, people try to polarize it. And the reality is, Robin, as Americans, we have a lot more in common than we have that's dissimilar. So instead of focusing on our differences, we have to start with what I believe we all have in common, a belief that we are now, today in this country, in a situation that's not okay. It's not okay for children to leave for school in the morning and not come home in the evening. It's not okay for people to go to church, synagogue, concerts, work, and not come home because of gun violence. So we have to start acknowledging that we are facing a problem, a public health crisis.
That's Dr. Joseph Sacharin, a gunshot survivor himself as a teenager and now a trauma surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. Dr. Sacharin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
And we reached out to the NRA to join us to talk about this. The invitation still stands. We're hoping to hear back.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Roughly 1 in 10 Americans say they're allergic to the most reliable antibiotic in the world, penicillin. But doctors and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been casting doubt on the widespread diagnosis, and they see it as a public health dilemma. From member station WPLN, Blake Farmer reports.
It's not just that many people who have an allergy in their charts are probably fine. It's most, says Dr. Elizabeth Phillips, an adverse drug reaction expert at Vanderbilt University Medical Center.
And when I say most, that would be 95% or more of patients that are labeled are not truly allergic to penicillin.
The stories are remarkably similar. Most get the allergy label by age 3, and Phillips says it's usually based on inaccurate assumptions and old science.
Most reactions that occur in childhood, in fact, are related to viruses or infections that the child has encountered. So, for instance, a rash.
I would just always break out in hives around my hands, my elbows, my knees. It was really weird.
Katie Lipscomb is a mother from Franklin, Tennessee. She suffered from frequent earaches as a kid and regularly took some form of penicillin. She also had occasional allergic reactions. So they figured the penicillin was to blame. She never had any testing to confirm, but it's still in her charts. And if she sees a new doctor...
Of course, they want to know if you're allergic to any kind of medicine. I've just always put penicillin because that's what I was always told.
She even had to wear a bright red bracelet while giving birth to her 3 children, warning doctors not to give her penicillin. But no one ever asked how she knew, even though studies now find even kids who had a legit allergy almost always outgrow it. The immunologists working to debunk the diagnosis admit they've probably been part of the problem themselves.
You know, even in my own practice, some of the things that I call penicillin allergy, I don't think that they really were penicillin allergy, but I didn't know what else to call them.
Dr. Cosby Stone of Vanderbilt says even a decade ago, researchers didn't realize that a penicillin allergy can go away and usually does. He's now working with colleagues to pilot a questionnaire that will probe deeper into patient stories starting early next year. Those with mild childhood reactions may be given the medication just to see what happens. He says the risk is pretty low. Others who had more serious experiences will get skin testing first. Several sites around the country are working on similar responses because an unnecessary penicillin allergy has a price. Even though there are alternatives, penicillin is often the cheapest and most effective antibiotic, especially when given to patients before surgery to preempt an infection. Studies have found patients with an allergy are much more likely to develop a surgical infection. Stone has an analogy.
You know, penicillin allergy to me is kind of like a tree that got planted too close to your house when you were a kid.
It's no problem at first, but over time, the tree begins to quietly loom over the house. And then, like trees do, it dies and becomes a disaster waiting to happen.
The infection that you get when you're not expecting it is the same as a storm that comes up on your house when you're not expecting it and strikes the tree, you know, that's right next to your house such that it falls on it. I mean, we often don't realize how many things we can do to prevent a bad outcome before it happens.
Of course, the challenge is getting patients to do something about it before they show up in an emergency room requiring trauma surgery. Stone predicts it will likely take a decade to re-educate patients and their doctors about the prevalence of penicillin allergies or lack thereof. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
In recent years, agents from ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, have been stepping up raids on franchises of the convenience store 7-Eleven. Some franchise owners claim that corporate 7-Eleven is using ICE to intervene in what are internal company disputes and to put pressure on shop owners that 7-Eleven considers troublemakers. Reporters from Bloomberg Businessweek investigated the relationship between ICE and 7-Eleven for a story that was published this week. Michael Smith is senior writer for Bloomberg. He co-authored the story with his colleague Lauren Etter. Michael, you write that on one day in January of this year, ICE agents raided 98 7-Eleven stores. They were in 17 states and in Washington, D.C. Did they find undocumented immigrants working, people working illegally?
Well, they arrested a few in January. I haven't heard about any other arrests, but they don't really publicize them always. So it's unclear how much they've actually found. But what is clear is that this company, the parent company, because this is a franchise company, so all the stores are basically independent contractors that are paying to use the 7-Eleven name and to operate under all their procedures. So the stores are almost their customers. And in this case, you have a company that is really, really putting a lot of pressure on store operators, and they're using potential violations of immigration law to really go after people they do not want to continue to be running their stores.
So this is the backdrop of all of this. You write about the internal strife between franchise owners and the 7-Eleven CEO, Joe DePinto, who has cracked down on franchisees since he took over and, as you write, to purge certain underperformers and troublemakers, suggesting that corporate 7-Eleven is using federal immigration authorities as leverage and kind of an enforcement tool in business disputes with franchisees. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly what the franchisees say, and that's certainly what has been alleged in multiple lawsuits. It's impossible to know whether they're actually sort of ratting out franchisees. We weren't able to show that without any doubts. But this is what the franchisees believe, because a number of the stores, for example, that were targeted, that were raided this year, happen to be owned by people who have been actively critical of the company's policies and also were involved in lawsuits against the company. We found several examples of that, and they just so happened to have been raided and also in disputes with the company.
So the franchise owners, what is their beef with the CEO, Joe DePinto? I mean, if they're filing suit against him, what's the basis for those suits?
Well, it's basically bad blood that goes back years, and it all boils down to money. Because DePinto, since he became CEO in the mid-2000s, he's basically worked to really, really improve profitability, which means getting a bigger cut, essentially, of the revenue and profits that every store generates. That's the way franchises work. The franchisees have said that he's basically just gone too far, and he's made it so that they really just can't make a living running a store because they take so much of their money, basically.
And because there's a mandate that, you know, somebody will come in disguised as a customer to make sure that all the Red Bull cans are front-facing, or, you know, that things like, well, I suppose, I don't know if this is a bad thing or not, but the Slurpee machines have to be cleaned every so often or repaired, and a repair can cost like $4,000 or $5,000. What are the mandates that the CEO is putting on franchise owners?
Well, over the last, say, decade, if you will, it's been a progressive tightening of the requirements that the company puts on stores in terms of what they have to do and the kind of scrutiny they come over. And it goes from everything like employees having to wear certain name tags to hundreds or thousands of items being in stock. And when they're not in stock, they can get sanctioned for that. And there's also significant scrutiny of things like bookkeeping and whether everything is going into the till or not. And so there's all kinds of surveillance, electronic surveillance and physical surveillance. But the main thing is just the company is always showing up at the store and saying, here's how you have to do things. It has to be this way, this way, this way. You got to order this, 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 and this. And all that adds up to a tremendous amount of sort of micromanagement of how stores that are supposed to be independent operators are allowed to operate.
So 7-Eleven says it has no advance warning of immigration raids and that only gives the government information about a franchise owner if corporate has reason to believe that crimes may be happening in the store. What is 7-Eleven specifically telling you about this?
Well, that's basically what they say. And again, they say we don't rat out our franchisees, so to speak. But if we find wrongdoing, we will turn that over to the federal government if we find any evidence of crimes, including immigration.
Michael Smith, reporter and senior writer for Bloomberg. We will link to the story that he wrote with his colleague Lauren Etter at hereandnow.org. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me.
This is a story about a woman who traveled miles to thank World War II veterans she never met but owed her life to. The woman is Deborah Long from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's an instructor and a genealogist and a daughter of Holocaust survivors. Since she was a little girl, she always wanted to know about her family's history, and eventually she made it her mission to find out who the American soldiers were who saved her mother from a concentration camp in Germany.
I've been doing a lot of reading of military books, and I came across this list for the liberating unit from Salzwedel, where my mom was emancipated, and came across Norman Carn's name. He was the lieutenant colonel for the division at that time. And I just started to Google Norman Carn's, found his obituary. Within a few steps, I was able to locate his son, Norman Carn's son, Bruce.
Long wanted to thank Bruce Carnes for what his father did in the war, rescue her mother from the camp. By some massive coincidence, Carnes' daughter, Sarah, happens to work at the Veterans Affairs Facility in Bedford, Massachusetts. She's the clinical librarian and a veteran. While her grandfather, the Liberator, is gone, Carnes invited Long to come up from North Carolina and thank other World War II veterans herself. Earlier this year, Long did come and told a group of them her story.
You're looking at a picture of my mother shortly after she was liberated from Salzwedel, Germany, which was a concentration work camp. She is still wearing the jacket that an American soldier gave her, even though this is months after liberation.
The vets were quiet during the presentation, but she spoke with each of them at the end. One of them was the former Army Sergeant Russell Lang, 106th Infantry. He's 97 now and was a prisoner of war, eager to tell her his story.
I was caught, and so the war was getting closer, and the bombs were down in the area. They were going boom, boom. I remember well, but I just wanted to tell you, I'm glad that you met you.
I'm glad to thank you.
Thank you.
She leans down to his wheelchair to give him a hug.
Thank you.
Thank you, dear.
For Deborah Long, having vets just see the family of Holocaust survivors is important.
Sometimes people don't realize what their impact is down the line. Many of them have suffered greatly about what they saw. They were very young boys, like my parents were very young, and I think many of them were traumatized and shocked and felt guilt at what they did or what they didn't do or what they couldn't do. And I wanted to let them know that, at least in my case, I can speak for my family, they saved a whole world of people.
So it's something you're doing for them and for you both.
Oh, definitely. I don't want to make this sound like it's selfless. I'm doing this as a way of honoring my parents. I'm a poor substitute for them, but it's better than I'm 60-some years late than not to say thank you at all.
The gift that Debbie's given us is priceless.
Sarah Carnes is the woman whose grandfather helped rescue Deborah Long's mother.
It was the missing puzzle piece. As a veteran myself, I've had the experience of going on deployments and not knowing whether the efforts and sacrifices that we had made a difference. And of course, as a relative of veterans, you know, you do wonder whether or not what they'd gone through, what their families had gone through, was worth the sacrifice. You know inherently that it was. But here we have proof that their efforts to combat the Nazis and to shut down the concentration camps was not in vain. To meet somebody who literally exists because of the efforts of veterans is of the most profound nature.
Sarah Carnes of the Bedford, Massachusetts VA, and before that, Deborah Long of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Their families are forever linked by the events in Germany in World War II.
Last month, the British science fiction show Doctor Who featured an episode from its first black writer. Author Mallory Blackman co-wrote the show about Rosa Parks. In it, the Doctor and her companions have to save Parks from a time-traveling would-be murderer. And the BBC drama isn't the only show that's taken on race recently. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has a look at that. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And I'm thinking that normally when we speak to you about race and television, it's programs that always deal with race. They're, you know, race-centric, and this seems different.
Yeah, I thought it was worth taking a look at some shows where race is not necessarily the main thing that they focus on, but they made a very specific effort to create storylines that talked about race and difference, and they did a pretty good job.
Okay, so let's take a look. Doctor Who focused on race in a couple of recent episodes. One show was about the 1947 partition of India. Another about Rosa Parks, as we said. And in the Rosa episode, we get to see characters interact with America in the 1950s. So give us a little about how the writers did that.
So this episode actually reminded me of a joke that a certain comic used to tell all the time about how if he had a time machine, he was a white comic, and he would say if he had a time machine, he could go back to any era in time, but black folks could only go back maybe 10 or 15 years before, you know, things got sticky. So this episode features the Doctor and her companions, humans who hang out with her, accidentally actually landing in Birmingham, Alabama in 1955. And one of her companions is a black man. And he picks up a glove that a white woman has dropped and tries to hand it to her, and her husband slaps him. And then Rosa Parks actually steps up to try and defuse the situation. And we have a clip. Let's listen to it.
Are you crazy?
He slapped me.
Did you read the newspapers? You know what they did to young Emmett Till?
We're from out of town.
So was Emmett Till. On vacation from the North, couple of words to a white woman in Mississippi, and the next thing, they find his body in the river. You all together?
Yes, we're very grateful, Miss...
Mrs. Parks, Rosa Parks.
Oh, what a payoff. That is so cool.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So when you have characters of color that are going back in time, it's hard to find a period where there weren't people of color being oppressed. Mm-hmm. And so to actually deal with that and say, hey, we know this has happened, and to also have this script be the product of the first non-white person to act as a writer on Doctor Who, it was just an amazing moment to watch for anybody who cares about equality.
Well, and time travel is shaping up to be a real way to bring race into programs. Let's turn to the fourth season of Outlander, the historical time travel drama from Starz. Main characters Claire and Jamie arrive in the new world in the 18th century, 1700s. They're taken in by Jamie's Aunt Shakasta on her plantation. She has more than 100 slaves. Now, Claire has traveled back in time from 1945. So how does she interact with slaves and slave owners?
Well, this is what's interesting. The episode explores the structure of slavery and how even when people who owned slaves wanted to try and free them, there were all these strictures in place to make it hard for them to do that. And I think we have a clip where Jocasta and Claire kind of discuss slaves, and Claire makes it plain how she feels and Jocasta makes it plain how she feels. Let's check it out.
Well, some are so dear to me, I consider them friends.
Do you think they feel the same way?
I'm not sure I catch the meaning you wish to convey, dear.
Perhaps they see things a little differently, since they don't exactly have any choice.
Oh, my slaves are quite happy here, I assure you. Why, only a few have tried to run away over the years.
Again, the Outlander show, in this moment, not only do they have to negotiate slavery, they also have to deal with Native Americans and the fact that the British are coming in and taking over this land. And we know how that story ends, right? Mm-hmm. As viewers, we know how that ends. So it's interesting to watch the show negotiate all these different ideas and not shy away from facing them as we've seen in other TV series.
Meanwhile, let's turn to the NBC drama This Is Us, a favorite. It has focused on how race affects our day-to-day lives since it first started, but a few of the recent episodes you point out have been really powerful. So just briefly, what's interesting to you about the way This Is Us has approached race?
Yeah, so we know This Is Us is this family drama, and three of the characters are related, but one of them is a black man who was adopted into the family. The white boy, or the white man, is dating a relative of the black man's wife. So he's dating a black woman now. And here's a little clip where the woman who's dating the white guy is wondering whether or not it's worth it to date him because he doesn't seem to understand what she's going through as a black woman. Let's check it out.
Today at the gas station, the cashier didn't realize we were together. And she was rude to me. Not in the obvious way, just...
I got it.
And Kevin, he was... Whew.
He didn't get it.
He didn't even see it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a wonderful way to sort of get at an element of negotiating an interracial relationship if it's the first time you've been in one. And I just love how This Is Us takes those little moments, those little things that people don't necessarily realize unless they've experienced it, and they turn it into really interesting storylines.
Yeah. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans with a look at, shows that he's applauding for their look at race. Eric, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.